On today's episode of Born to Know, I'm thrilled to be joined by Sterna Suisa, a trauma-informed parenting expert who brings a refreshingly real and compassionate lens to the parenting journey. Sterna's work is rooted in the lived experiences of parents navigating the complex, often messy terrain of raising children in today's modern, disjointed world. In our conversation, we dive deep into how modern society can provide meaningful rites of passage for our children, even in the absence of traditional family structures. Sterna shares powerful insights on the importance of intergenerational relationships and how children can form a strong sense of identity and belonging. We also explore the generational ripple effects of unresolved trauma and why children often seek answers outside the family when parents aren't honest, especially about sensitive topics like sex, boundaries, death, and autonomy. We talk about the harm that comes from teaching children to ignore their instincts in the name of politeness, the dangers of parental control, and how emotional outbursts are actually an invitation for growth for both the child and the parent. Whether you're a new parent or deep in the teenage years, or maybe you're looking to find some closure about how you were raised, this episode is filled with wisdom to help you foster a more connected, resilient, and emotionally intelligent relationship with your children and yourself. Let's dive in. Sterna, thank you so much for joining me. I've been following your content for some time now. It's been incredibly beautiful to not only experience your content and what you're sharing, but then also read through the comments and hear about, you know, men and women's experiences in reflecting on how they're showing up for their children and even noticing where they could expand and change perspective on something that they might have been doing for some time that may not be working anymore, right? And that's one of the beautiful things about this journey as a parent is that we have a lot of opportunities, I'd say maybe on a daily basis, to disrupt a pattern. So thank you. Thank you for what you do and for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on your podcast. And for reading through the content that I share. My favorite place is the comment section because it adds so much nuance and like the realness of parenting. You know, there's only so much that I can put in a post. There's the real experiences and the real questions that show up in the comments. And I actually love hearing from parents, their experiences, and discussing with everybody that shares in the comment section.
Okay, so I have a lot of questions for you. Like as I was reflecting on having this conversation, I was like, oh, I want to ask her about choice and I want to ask her about initiations. And so I would really love to start by asking you what you believe appropriate initiations are for boys and girls and how does that happen now? Because we're at a time and we're in a culture where boys and girls don't experience a lot of initiations. And what does that mean, right? Like historically, cross-culturally, boys and girls had different rites of passage that they would go through. And there are ways of existing in their community or in their family that gave them like incrementally more and more responsibility to start to transition into a role of, you know, young woman, young man. So I really believe that that's often lacking from what I see working in birth, in postpartum, and kind of the periphery of child rearing. And so do you see that there are initiations for boys and girls, and what are they, and how can we offer that to our children?
Right. So in my circles, and I know you mentioned this in another podcast that I listened to, where you spoke about bat and bar mitzvah, where there's this initiation into, you know, the teenage years of becoming a man or a woman. No matter what belief system any family has, we can actually create that for our child. you know, celebrate the fact that our child is now entering a new stage in their life. And oftentimes what I'm seeing is that due to a lot of parents breaking generational traumas, there's the lack of certain family members participating in, you know, different events or celebrations. So sometimes that is something that can get in the way of a family saying, hey, you know what, I want to celebrate my child, but look, you know, my parents are not involved. They're not willing to be included, or it's going to be chaotic if we do include them. And so I think it's important to not get stuck on the fact that, you know, we wish certain individuals would celebrate in a certain way with us. Rather, create that for our child. You know, look in our circles. What are the male figures that we can, you know, bring together for our son entering manhood? What are the females that we know in our surroundings that we can include for, you know, celebrating our daughter entering womanhood? And making it a point. At the end of the day, it's on us, you know, and putting that aside, also how we feel with being a woman or a man, right? Are we celebrating the fact that, you know, all the beautiful aspects of being who we are? Our children sense that and feel that, and feel that it's a beautiful thing when we feel that way about our own self.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I notice is that in present day, you know, and being a mom of a daughter, so much of my energy was focused for a while on getting her together with other kids. It was like, oh, she needs to play with other kids, other kids, other kids. And what I started to realize was actually it would really be beneficial for her to spend time with me and the women that I associate with, and for her to see how we interact when we get together. We drink tea, we sit outside, we talk. And why can't there be multiple ages? Like, why does it have to be so isolated that, you know, only women get together, and then when we get together with our friends, so that the kids can play separately, but we don't actually interact? And something that's really missing is multiple generations in one space to show children, you know, to have this reciprocal relationship of, this is what the elderly do, this is what the elders in our family do or in our community do, this is what, you know, middle age and then young adult and then adolescent. And there's not enough of that. And then it's cemented by the fact that we have grades, right? So something I enjoy about, one of the things that I enjoy about the Montessori approach is that there's multiple ages in one classroom, so that children are getting exposed to different developmental stages of a child's life, rather than you're only with 9-year-olds every single day for an entire year, because what are they learning really, you know? So. Yeah.
And I think that we can show that through our interactions. Like, I have friends of all ages. All ages, from teenagers all the way to people in their 90s, and showing our children that everyone can learn from everyone. And more importantly, surrounding ourselves with individuals that can celebrate us, you know, that our child sees that we have, you know, this sisterhood with a group of friends, that we're here to celebrate and lift each other up. I think that's really important for our children to see that.
Yeah, one of my close friends, she had a ceremony for her daughter when she began menstruating. And so she asked us all to come wearing red or pink or purple, a variation of those colors, and for us to write something out to read to her in a circle, mm-hmm. and then an offering that would support her in, you know, this transition. And she asked her daughter, you know, do you want this to happen? And she said, yeah, I would love that. And so it wasn't a group of her friends. She had three girlfriends there. However, it was mostly, you know, women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, all speaking about, you know, what they would have loved at this time and what helped them at this time. And she asked her other daughter, you know, when the time came for her, do you want that same ceremony? And she said, no, actually, I would just like to go spend some time with you. Right. So obviously, every girl is going to have a different desire, but it made her, you know, it supported her having a positive association with this transition into womanhood. Whereas, you know, very often, maybe someone who's listening can relate that some of our moms didn't handle it in the best way. And it was actually interwoven with a lot of shame. You know, I remember having a girlfriend when she began menstruating. Her mom said to her,
oh, great, like to herself, said, oh, great, now another one to worry about. And she looked at her and said, you better not get pregnant. It's the first thing she heard from her mother. So, you know, and there's variations of that, right? Or just kind of shoving it under the rug and maybe just handing her a Maxipad and saying, you know, oh,
kind of. Exactly. No, it's first of all, it's beautiful what you mentioned about, you know, the mother turning to their daughters and saying, how would you like to celebrate this? I have some, you know, options. We have some choices. And it comes down to back to what you're saying is, how do we feel about this? If we feel, you know, that we found the beauty in it and we think it's something positive, then that's what we're going to be giving over to our child. And it's really important. I think that's really important.
You brought that up recently in a post you shared, it was a post you shared where you said that one of your clients, I think it was driving with their child and the child saw a cemetery and asked, you know, what is that? And I believe the mother responded, or maybe didn't respond, or kind of blew it off.
Yes.
And, you know, you had a different approach to that with your children. So when we don't feel comfortable with a certain subject in our lives, we then pass that on to our children, right? Where there's either no information, or there's shame, or there's even like a punishing that can happen when a child asks about something that the adult has not personally resolved or made peace with. What are some other examples that you've come across?
That's a really good example. We can just touch this, the one that you just brought up, if you want, and then we'll could talk about something else also. So in regards to death, you see, death is something that is sad that happens in society. It is sad when, you know, an individual is now ready to transition into a different place. However, I don't have any fears around death. So because that I don't have any fears, when my kids bring up this topic, I'm totally okay talking to them about it. Versus if a parent has fears, is uncomfortable, you know, looks at it as something so terrible and like, let's not even talk about it because I can't even talk about this or deal with this, then that's going to be transferred on to their kids in the way that that mom basically brushed off, like, no, that's nothing. Let's continue driving. You know, when the child said, what is that, to the cemetery? Now, when we're very uncomfortable about a certain topic, and we all have topics we're uncomfortable about, it's important to be honest with our children when talking about it. So saying like, you know, right now you might feel that I'm uncomfortable with this question. And that's true. I am uncomfortable. No one ever spoke to me about this when I grew up. It's going to be the first time that I'm going to be trying to explain something to you when nobody did that to me. So I have no idea how, and I'm going to try my best. Or you could say something like, I'd love to answer that question. That's a really good question. Let me put my words together. Let me put my thoughts together so I make sure to answer you in the best way possible. So even if our children are asking us questions and we feel like we don't have the capacity to answer right away, we can take the time needed while being honest with our child. That being said, as parents, nowadays, we have to really think about the fact that Google exists. And a child, we don't know at what age, might be Googling all sorts of stuff, especially if they feel that we aren't their source of information, their honest source of information. And we lose out. We actually lose out when a child goes on Google, because Google will not share our values with our child. And if we want to make sure that we're passing on our values to our children and having a real life conversation about the questions they have, Google won't give that to our child. The one thing that Google will not do to our child is it will not shame them. It will not make them feel like their question is wrong or embarrassing, or they will feel comfortable, you know, like Google will just answer questions, show images, and all of that will be given to our child, versus a child knowing, I don't need to Google it. Let me go see my mom. Let me go see my dad. They're going to tell me, everything there is to know about this topic, and I can trust them. I could believe them. That's very, very powerful. And I think it's so important. It's so important because of living right now in a time where there's an abundance of information out there. And we really want to be the source of information for our children.
Absolutely. That I just had a conversation with someone recently, and this has happened a few times over the last year, where they were uncertain about something or having a difficult moment, and they consulted ChatGPT. And when I asked them, you know, what was that like? Like, did you get a result that, you know, resonated with you? And they said, yeah, actually, like, one of the things was that I didn't feel judged by ChatGPT. And so you brought that up about shame, right? Where it's like you look something up on Google and there's just information there. And so when we haven't, as adults or parents, processed our own shame around a certain subject matter, you know, we pass that on in our answers or in our conversation with our children, you know, and I see that a lot actually around the conversation of birth, because as a doula and birth educator, you know, over the years, there's already existing toddlers or children. And some of the parents say, I don't know how to explain, you know, what the birth process is like. And I don't think it's okay for the child to be there in the room. You know, I don't want it to adulterate them. And I ask them, well, what about birth feels, you know, like, why is it sexualized for you? And then, you know, the deeper question is, why is there shame around sex? Because the way that this, you know, baby was created was through sex. You know, it's just the simple fact of procreation. And so at what point do you want your child to learn about sex if not through witnessing birth, which is just, you know, it's the purpose of it, really. It's the biological purpose of this act. And so we've done a lot of work around, you know, what it is to have children at birth. And so if we're talking about death, which is one thing that is very often shoved in the closet, you know, the elderly, the subject of them is also very often shoved in the closet. What happens as we age and then approach death? A lot of people don't talk to their kids about that. But the other one is birth and procreation. That is very often shoved in the closet. You know, I don't want anyone to know how it is or what goes on behind the closed doors. And, you know, of course, there's privacy. That's a different subject. It's not what I'm talking about here. But how have you addressed that with the families that you work with, you know, when it comes to the subject?
Yeah, I see a lot of parents also lying to their kids, which, I mean,
yeah,
kids are going to know the truth. And all they're going to find out is that the parent was a liar. Like, there's no way out. Like, if you're not saying the truth to your child, they're going to know one day that that's a lie, you know? So I think it's really important to answer the questions children have. And as like you're saying, like, it's biology, it's facts. There's nothing more to it. You know, the same way, even when I talk about death, like I the first time I spoke about death to my kids was in the fall. All the leaves are dying, right? This is the death of the leaves. The leaves are dying and there's going to be a renewal. So it's just, it's just as a fact. There's nothing more to it. And children don't see things with the same lenses that we do. You know, if we have shame or discomfort or we see certain things a certain way, unless we share that with our kids, they're very open to ideas and they see it with so much purity and beauty, you know?
Yeah. I mean, just really reflecting on the cycles of life, that could exactly be the best guide for us. You know, the way that I did it was my daughter would come to births with me, but I also, to explain sex as it is, let's say, I just showed her animal videos, right? Like basic National Geographic and other types of documentaries. And she started to understand, oh, there are cycles in nature and there's cycles in, you know, the biological animal life, right? So at a certain time of the year, these animals will migrate to meet the male counterpart or vice versa, yes, to create babies. And then there's shared responsibilities. The roles are different. And then the season will pass. They have to move again to find food. And then these babies have now matured and they're the ones who are going to now start to look for their mate. So it's like, what better way to explain all of this, yeah, than through the cycles that the earth experiences? And this is, you know, like you said, it's a fact. And I, unfortunately, there's a lot of unresolved trauma and shame when it comes to, you know, sex, procreation, touch, which leads me into, you know, a very hot topic, which is the idea of unwanted touch or a child learning what I call the formula for self-betrayal very early on in childhood, because they are told, for whatever reasons, cultural, let's say, that when someone comes into the room or someone is, you know, even if it's a family member or a new person or a friend, that they either have to shake hands or they have to hug or they have to give kisses, even if they're not feeling inspired to do so. I mean, the rule in my home was always, if we want to call it a rule, is we'll always acknowledge the new person that enters the room, but physical touch is not required unless you feel inspired to connect, right? So we have a lot of conversations around boundaries. And so some people, I've had people say, well, you know, like, let's do a high five. And she's like, I don't want, like, she doesn't even know them, you know? And then someone said to me once, like, you know, that was a little rude. She didn't, you know, I went to hug her and I'm like, she doesn't know you. Like, this is the first time she's meeting you. And I was surprised that they said that to me. And it's like, do I want my daughter to override her intuition or instinct just so that some other adult's comfort and needs are met? And so, in your experience, you know, in your work, how is that navigated? Because I suspect most parents don't want their children to grow up in patterns of self-betrayal, yet they are requiring them to do things that go against what their body is telling them not to do.
Yes. I just want to circle back before I get to that, that when you were talking about the animal videos, I grew up in a very, very sheltered home, sheltered community, no TV, nothing. And the one thing that my father used to let me watch was every Sunday, National Geography, new videos would come up about different animals around the world. And yeah. Little did he know that I was getting so educated on matters that he was like sheltering me from, you know? Right. I wasn't even allowed to like look or talk to a boy, you know? I was really, really sheltered. And it was very educational. And that is how I got my education, which it's just funny because it ties into what you said. Now, back to what you're talking about, body boundaries. There are certain cultures that if you don't, you know, tell the child to go hug and kiss even their uncle that they haven't seen in they've never met, you know, it's the first time that they've met their uncle and their uncle comes over, like, there are some cultures that it's considered disrespectful. And like you said, you know, it's interesting how a little human being, no one is thinking about what if it's disrespectful to the child? Like, what if that is actually going against how the child feels for the sake of respecting an adult? Why is it that the comfort of the adult comes before the comfort of a little human being? And then that same child who grows up in that sort of culture is told as they get older, you know, listen to how you feel, you know, oh, well, how do you feel about, and like suddenly they don't even know. They don't even know themselves because all they know is what they're told to do. And like you said, it overrides their natural instinct of what feels comfortable for them. And that's so important. It ties in with a child's confidence. If a child cannot trust how they feel, then they lack confidence in doing things, whatever it is. Because as soon as a child is in tuned with themselves and say, my body feels this way, I feel capable or I feel incapable, they're gaining self-confidence. And we take that away from them every time we say, go hug, go kiss. Just ignore how you're feeling. How you're feeling? No. That doesn't really matter right now. You know, take care of the adult. Please them. Make sure they feel comfortable in my home. And when they meet you, they cannot feel disrespected. And this triggers a lot of the elder generations, specifically in these types of cultures. And I understand that it triggers them because I imagine them as a child also having, you know, been forced into doing that. And now they're the elder. They are now at that age where others are supposed to do that to them. And here we are, a generation of parents where a lot of us are saying, whoa, hold on. I have to rethink this. This doesn't feel right. I also want to consider my child. I think a lot of parents, due to also sexual abuse prevention that is getting louder, I think a lot of the parents out there are now, as soon as they, you know, take some time to really think through this, they are starting to respect more and more their little children and understanding that we cannot demand things of little kids and then have other expectations as they grow older.
100%. It's there's two things that came up for me as you were speaking. One was, just so I can bookmark it, so my brain is firing off right now, but is teaching children discernment, right? And the other is the taking care of the adult, right? Grooming our children to be caretakers when it's actually not their responsibility. You know, there are perhaps chores and roles that happen in a home. Everybody participates. You know, the child, as they get older, start to take on new responsibilities in the home. My daughter is now cooking food for everyone. All she can make are like eggs and a few other dishes. But it's, you know, what she was inspired to do it. And she's always cooked with me, but now she feels confident around the stove, you know, and it's coming from within. It's her deep desire to do so. But there was never like a punishment of like, if you don't, or a threat, like if you don't do this by now, then you're not going to get this, right? And I've actually been around some people in other cultures that have that. You need to be doing this by this certain age. You know, this is just what's right. And so the child feels like they're not right or they're wrong because they haven't found, you know, inspiration to do that yet, right? So anyway, caretaking the adult. I recently heard there was a conflict between a child and an adult where the adult wanted the child to do something and the child was still involved in another activity. And, you know, I'm close enough with them that I made the suggestion where I asked the child, how much more time do you need before you feel like you're complete with what you're doing? And they said, I don't know, I was in the middle of it, right? Because for a child, like they're processing at a different rate. And so I've always made it a point personally to let my daughter know in 10 minutes, this is happening. Like, you know, just so that she can have some sense of time frames if we need to do something or switch what we're doing so that she feels prepared. But, you know, just coming in and extracting a child when they're in the middle of a process, I always ask the adults, like, what would that feel like for you? You're in the middle of writing an email. Someone literally picks you up, just or takes you away.
Shuts your computer.
Shuts your computer. And you're done eating, takes the food or whatever it is. And it's like, you would feel completely disrespected. And some adults have said to me, you know, I'm the adult. They're the child. So there's this level of violence. And what I mean by that is actions taken without consent. And people say, well, it's not violent. I didn't hit. I didn't scream. I didn't threaten. But really, we're in a culture of violence. It's all around us in many different ways because things are done without the consent of the other. But something about a child who appears to be helpless, so many adults exercise, I would say, or offload, discharge a lot of their trauma from their own childhood by exerting force and violence onto children, whether it be picking them up in the middle of an activity, shutting the computer off while they're in the middle of, you know, reading something or an audiobook, turning it off, you know, it's time. So those for me, yes, of course, it's not physical violence, but it's a complete disrespect for their autonomy and for their natural rhythm. And, you know, now the child says, oh, I can't relax here. I don't feel safe here. They start getting that messaging and then the dynamic completely shifts. So first, what would you say, you know, to adults who have that belief, I'm the adult, they're the child, they need to do what I say?
What it sounds also, as I hear you speaking, is I'm the adult and my child is in my object, right? It sounds like I'm forgetting that this child has feelings, has, you know, their own thoughts, their own things that they like and dislike. You know, it almost sounds like that. Like, I'm the adult and this is you know, my object or my little puppy almost, you know? And really, when I hear this is, I'm the adult and you're the child, I would challenge that and say, yeah, you are so right. You are the adult. You're the one that is supposed to already at this stage in adulthood know how to have impulse control, know how to be emotionally immature and intelligent, know how to be present. It is not on a child's, in their development as a child, to have all that at that stage. So yeah, it's true. We are the adults and we are the ones that need to act like the adult in the relationship versus imposing on a little child to already have aspects of adulthood, things that they can figure out in adulthood later on as their brain develops. So another thing is for these parents that have this mindset is understanding that it's easy to say that when we have a little child, you know, I'm the adult and they're the child. One day, very soon, your child is going to be older. So it's going to be, I'm the adult and I have a teen. A teen has access to more. A teen has more independence, whether we like it or not. I mean, a teen can just walk out of our house. What are we going to do? Lock them in? Like, there are certain things that teenagers have access to that the parent in that mindset will completely lose all control, the illusion of control they had. So it's an illusion. When children are young and you think that you have control over this child, it's an illusion because that control disappears at one stage or another. And all that's left is absolutely nothing if you didn't work on the connection and the relationship. So it's a recipe for disaster, I would say. It's the same parents that say, you know, teenagers are hard. Teenagers are hell to raise, you know, wait till you see till they're teens. Yeah, I understand that because teens cannot be manipulated anymore. They cannot be treated like an object anymore. So I get you're having a hard time, you know, but if throughout all these years, there was connection being built, there wasn't, you know, tactics of manipulation and seeing that our child is a human being, by the time they're teens, like, wow, we've had so many years building this relationship. Like, it's actually so beautiful to spend time together, to have this deeper understanding of each other, to have already this trust between us. Like, it's just night and day, you know?
Yeah, it's giving me chills just hearing you say this because I've had this conversation with many of my girlfriends have two daughters. It's really interesting. Like some of my closest friends, we all have daughters. Some of us have just one, some of us have two, and they all have these very connected relationships with their daughters, and their daughters are vastly different from one another. You know, I never believe siblings have as much similarity as we might want to believe.
Yes.
and one of the things that has come up is this idea that how a child, right, when a child grows up, becomes a young adult, how they treat their parent is how they felt as a child growing up with their parent. And so I do know women and men too, who have a very, let's say, like tenuous relationship with their parent. You know, maybe the primary caregiver was the mother, and it's like the mother calls and then they don't really want to answer the phone, and they, yeah, you know, it's like something comes up for their, you know, in their nervous system, there's like some, yeah, regulation they have to do. And, you know, there isn't safety there, and the parent can't understand, you know, and maybe things have been addressed. Oh yeah, the things I did when you were a kid, you know, it's behind us. It was 30 years ago, 40 years ago, but that adult is still, you know, that safety that maybe wasn't there, or the connection that you've mentioned, maybe because there was a lot of shame in the household or a lot of, you know, whatever, instability and, you know, narcissism, all the things that can create very unsafe environments for children. You know, it's still something that maybe that adult hasn't resolved, or maybe they've worked on it, but, you know, it's hard to get there. So when you talk about this connection, what are some of the key ways that someone listening right now can start to forge that? Would you say it's primarily creating safety? And what does that mean to create safety for a child?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I also want to take a moment to share that if there are any parents listening to this and they feel like I haven't spent, you know, my child's younger years parenting in this way, like there's never a time where we can't just step in and say, you know what, I'm going to begin to do things differently. I'm going to begin to listen to my child more, to take them into consideration more, to work on collaborating more. And those are the components of connection along with being honest. Now, if there's a relationship between a child and a parent, and a lot of things have happened in the past, it could be very hard for a child to just turn the page on all of that as soon as a parent decides, hey, you know, I want things to be different. The first step of connection would be to really try to repair the past by listening to our child and seeing what are the ways I failed to show up in the best way possible for my child. What are they telling me and how can I repair that? Most things are repairable. It's a matter of listening, acknowledging, and validating that whatever our child is sharing with us, that's their reality, even though we might have different feelings around the event. A lot of times, a parent will talk to a child and their child will bring up things that they've done, understanding that it doesn't take away all the positive things that you've done too. Just because our child has something negative to share with us, it doesn't mean that there aren't also positive things. Back to your question in regards to connection. So connection, a lot of the times, is confused with attention. Parents will sit in the same room and, you know, cheer their child on like, wow, great. Oh yeah, amazing. That's not connection. Connection is having eye contact with our child, getting curious, not thinking we know what they're up to, what they've done, getting curious. Hey, how did you come up with this? How did you think about this? Oh, tell me more about this drawing. Oh, this looks so interesting. You know, I want to hear more about this. So having connection is also through physical touch, right? So telling a child, hey, do you want to share that with me while you sit on my lap? Or, you know, comforting them and rubbing their back, being there with them. The best way to describe the difference between attention and connection is it's an example as if you go to like a concert. If I'm sitting there in the audience watching an artist sing, so I hear them singing and I'm cheering them on and maybe singing along and I'm there with them, but I'm in the crowd and I'm just cheering them on. There's no real connection, but I did give that artist attention. If I go backstage and I meet the artist and I say, hey, I want to get to know you. Like, I'm not assuming I know them because of their songs that they sing. Like, I actually want to get to know you. Could we like hang out? Could we talk? And you have eye contact and physical touch and you get to know them, that's connection. So sometimes parents are really good at giving kids attention and they don't get like, why is my child so clingy? Or why are they always, you know, trying to get more attention from me? It's not the attention. Most likely it's the connection piece. As human beings, we need both. We need attention and connection, but connection is really important.
Absolutely. And it's not just a body in the room. It's what I say, because when I work with couples who are preparing for their birth experience, we do this thing called the bossy massage. It originally came from Dr. Betty Martin, where, you know, the man might hold the woman's hand and ask her how she would like to be touched. And there's been so many different responses that have come through in that exercise. Like, I remember one woman said, I don't know, whatever you want to do, right? Someone else said to her husband, maybe just do it like this. Like, do you like that? like asking him what he liked when he was supposed to give her something. And one woman, as soon as he grabbed her hand and looked at her in the eye, she just started crying. And so when I asked, you know, what's coming up for you, you know, one of the women said, you know, the one who asked her husband, you know, do whatever you want to do, or that's what she told them. She said, no one's ever really asked me, like, I don't want to be bossy. So, you know, I always think, what happened way back when your primary caregiver, you know, maybe said you were being too much, or, you know, you asked for something and they made it seem like an unreasonable request, or what was quality time like, and what was physical touch like in your home? And, you know, so I ask those questions, not because I know the answers or the formula to fix it, but simply because I want to inspire a reflection on what's possible for them now, and that they're not actually, you know, back there in their playroom at 4 years old, you know, not being seen, not being connected with, you know. And so it's a really great opportunity. And the one woman who cried, she said, you know, I don't remember my parents ever asking me, you know, how I wanted to be touched. And she's like, it's just bringing up a lot of feelings, because I always thought I didn't like touch. But what I'm realizing sitting here is that I actually really do want it. I just, like, I feel like a stranger to it. And so what you're saying about creating connection through touch, it's like, I like to ask my daughter, because she's not into a lot. Like, she says, I'm not into PDA. It's so funny, because when she's a baby, she's like so all over me all the time. And then, like, you know, in the last 2 years, she's like, you know, what can I walk over here? And sometimes she grabs my hand, but I always ask her, do you want to hold hands? And she's like, yeah. Or she says, no. And can I hug you? You know, and sometimes I say to her, I really want to hug you. I feel so much love right now. And I'm like, can we, you know? And she's like, okay. And it's because I want her to feel what it is inside of her body to say yes or to say no. You know, and then sometimes I do surprise her, but it's just to create, and she laughs, you know, and it's just to create that familiarity with the feeling of what it's like when we're asked, you know, how do I reach into the depths of my system and my body to really get clear on what this feels like. And this is how we might teach our children discernment. Because right now, I'm noticing there's a lot of helicopter parenting going on, and I don't want my children to ever feel discomfort, and I have to protect them from everything. And, you know, a lot of women, their entire identity is wrapped up in the service to their child. And so they feel that they have to do everything. I mean, I see that with one of my family members. It's like, her daughter is 18, about to go to college, and, you know, she still orders for her at the restaurant. She still, you know, prepares everything for her. And I see that child kind of walk on her like a doormat, in a sense, because she doesn't respect her, because she says, I don't feel respected because I don't believe my mom trusts me to make decisions for myself. So I feel like it's very hard to respect her. And I was like, wow, what a level of self-awareness, you know, to be able to notice that. And so anyway, how do we teach our children discernment?
There's another layer sometimes to that, where I'm going to say a mother, because of your example. So let's say this mother, where would, like, maybe she feels valued by doing things for her daughter. And right. As the daughter gets older, what would be the mother's value without doing those things?
Right.
There's a level of that also. Being needed gives her value. So I need my child to need me, and I'm going to make them need me. Oftentimes that's also happening in relationships where parents are helicoptering, like they feel their child can't survive without them. When in reality, they are the ones that can survive, or feels like they can survive, without helicoptering their child. It's taking away from a child their own individuality of who they are. It's like robbing their identity, you know? And for a child growing up in such an environment, it literally could feel like someone took away my identity. I have no idea what I like, what I don't like, like you're even seeing with these parents, right? Like, I don't know. You tell me how I should be touched. Like, I have no idea. I'm the one living in my body and I don't even know how to be touched, how I want to be touched. So it creates also a dynamic where the same parents will say things like, why can't you just be independent? Look how much I'm doing for you, you know? When it's like, hold on, who created that dynamic? You know, children, if we notice from a very young age, grow into interdependence. They naturally do it, you know, in small little ways. And us as parents, we need to let them feel capable, let them feel valued, let them see that they can contribute. And it's in the smallest ways. Like, for example, I remember, you know, every day going to the park, I would hold my little child's knapsack. And then one day they're like, hey, I want to hold my own knapsack. I could have told my child, oh, it's too heavy, forget it, I have it, don't worry. No, you want to put it on your back? Let's do it. And I put it on my child's little back. And at the time they were a little toddler and they felt so capable. Like, I can hold my own bag. Like, wow, this is amazing. And they know that I have their back if they also need help. But I'm in those small little ways, we allow children. And if we are open to this, we will see when our children reach out to be independent. And it's our role to say, you want this? Let's see how I can make this happen for you.
So this might be a way that they learn that discernment is when we give them the opportunity to take an action or assume maybe some more responsibility or, you know, face adversity, let's say, yes. Right? Like I had this conversation with Dr. Tom Cowan recently, and he mentioned the Nakhon School in Europe where there's a big tree in the center of the campus and kids of all ages go there. No one helps the children climb the tree. They all are fascinated with this tree and they circle the tree and they'll climb, and they might slide down. They haven't made it to that point where maybe the older kids or the more practiced kids have made it, but they focus on getting there and no one can help them up because it's something that they have to figure out. And he said, I noticed that with my own grandchildren. We were at a playground and my granddaughter kept trying and trying, and finally I just hoisted one of her feet up. And when we went back to the playground the next day, she had no interest in climbing the thing. And so for me, it's illuminating because there's so much of us that wants the child just to feel all this ease and all this fluidity. And I believe we really just create that by creating safety and trust, and everything else is for them to explore, you know, and that sense of accomplishment is what starts to support that discernment. And what you said too about the internet, it's like, be honest, I'm always honest with my daughter. I say, I don't actually know the answer to that. And sometimes I say, do you want to go to the library and see what we can find? Because we create time for that. I don't want her to see me. This is my own personal thing. And it's nothing wrong with anyone who does this, but I don't want her to see me always going to my computer or phone to find out information.
Yeah.
You know? And so I will make an effort to go to places like books or, you know, I go to the dictionary and we have a thesaurus, you know, I look at synonyms instead of, I could do it so quickly online, but I open the book, you know, to let her know that sometimes the things we want require more time. And sometimes the things we want require us to figure it out and solve a problem without this kind of like overlord of tech. You know, so this way she learns a little more discernment.
Yes. And it's interesting that you brought up this example with the tree. We're very lucky as parents to be teaching discernment with small things that might not matter so much until children get to practice, you know, with those small things until they get older. And then it becomes more serious. You know, choices and things that they're going to be doing. So what happens is sometimes when, you know, there are situations around stickers or around rocks or around leaves, like, you know, parents will just get involved like, oh, okay, you guys are arguing over stickers. Like, oh, you know what? It's like a dollar. I'm going to buy you another pack. And they completely miss the point because it's not about the stickers. It's about figuring out how to resolve this problem that we're faced with. And so helicopter parents are actually taking away those opportunities by being there all the time, fixing all the issues, and then not realizing that this is the practice for adulthood, for teenagehood. When situations rise up, problems come up, challenges come up, and a child now has to figure it out. And so what I'm saying is when children are young and it's over Legos, crayons, stickers, like that's a real big blessing that it's over those, you know, things that are so minor, and not to get so stuck on like, oh, but it's anyway such a small thing. It's not about the thing. Look at the bigger picture is what I'm saying.
What do you say to parents? This has always fascinated me, where it's like a child is in the middle of eating something, you know, maybe they get a cookie. They don't normally get cookies. And then another child comes along, they have their own snacks, whatever it is, and they're grabbing at the thing. And the parent says, you have to share, you know, and the child's like, wait, I just got this thing. I never get it. It's a treat, right? So what is this whole you have to share? I mean, because there's a big concern with teaching sharing, because I see that parents feel really embarrassed in front of the other parent that their child looks like they're not a sharer.
Yes,
you know, so exactly. I see this whole thing happening on the playground and I'm like, wow, you know, and then the child's like, are you on my side? Like, whose side are you on?
Yeah.
So what's the deal with sharing?
Oh, so back to what I'm saying, you know, right now we're dealing with sharing cookies or the shovel at the park or the sticks you have, or, you know, things that seem so minor in adult eyes, like, oh, it's just a little cookie, like share. But really, if we look at the bigger picture, how do we want our child to share their energy, their time, their money, their belongings when they are adults? So it doesn't just come down to things. It's also a child's time and energy and all of that. Like, are they supposed to say yes to everything everybody asks of them? Or will there be moments where they need to say no? And if a parent says, oh yeah, of course, my child has to say no to certain things in life so that they can, you know, protect their own well-being, well, then the practice starts over cookies. It is. It just is what it is. A child needs to know that they can deceive someone and it does not mean that their choice was wrong. Just because they said no to something and their friend now is now crying, it's hard. I get it. We can have empathy for the situation and our child can say no in a compassionate way. However, it's okay to say no. And it's okay for others not to like our decisions. And this begins in childhood. Childhood is the blueprint for all future relationships. So whatever our children learn within the first 7 years of their life becomes like their baseline. So if a parent teaches a child, hey, you have your own belongings. And these belongings, you get to decide who you want to share with, how much of it you want to share of it, and all of that. It's up to you. Then a child grows up knowing that they have their own belongings. Now, when a child is young, we might not see them sharing, you know, naturally like that. And that's part of development. A child first needs to become their own self. If we think of sharing, it's, I'm giving you something from me, but first I need to have a me to give you. So allow the child, when a child is young, to develop the me. And then they will develop the giving to you from their own self. Naturally, as human beings, it feels good to give. There's this natural component of, as human beings, we want to give. It feels good to contribute. It feels nice to give. However, when we step in and force a child to give before they've even developed their own self and their own boundaries and all of that, it becomes something negative. Like, ugh, I'm always forced to give. I don't like giving. I don't like sharing. Oh, no. I'm going to go hide when I eat my cookies so nobody sees me so I don't have to share, you know? And it becomes like something negative for them, versus you might see some kids, you know, opening up a bag of cookies and saying, hey, let me give to everybody, because it feels good. But if a child was always forced, then obviously there's this negative component to sharing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Would you say that this might be part of what's responsible for adults who grow up viewing relationships as transactional, even romantic relationships as transactional? I mean, I know that's a much bigger subject, but it just makes me wonder, like, where, because I see that a lot, where it's like, if you do for me, then I'll do a little more for you, even in a marriage, you know?
For sure.
What have you done today that would inspire me to do this? And there's always like a tabulation going on.
Exactly. And it's conditional. It's like, I'll give you this if you give me that. And that doesn't feel good. It almost feels like I'm doing so that you could do back for me. It doesn't feel good. And for sure, that stems from the first 7 years of that child's life where everything was transactional, right? If you do this, you know, then I'll do this. And it's all about, it actually is the opposite of empathy and the opposite of actually giving, because now it becomes, what will I get? It's all about me. It's entitlement. It's, I'm giving, but because what will I get in return? This reminds me of a child that once came over to my house, and my kids were playing, and suddenly this child that came over was crying. So I went to see her and I said, you know, what's going on? And she said, well, I'm the guest in your house, and your daughters, they didn't give me the toy first. I'm the guest. I'm supposed to have it first. So I looked at her and I said, oh, that's so interesting. You're the guest. You're supposed to have it first. That's what you believe? She said, absolutely. Why are your daughters so mean? So I looked at her and I said, well, tell me how it is in your house. Is that how it works in your house when you have a guest? And she said, yes. When someone comes over, I have to give them whatever I want first. So I said, thanks for sharing how it's in your house. But I'm so sorry to tell you that that's not how it is in my house. In my house, whoever gets the item first gets the turn first, like if it's a family item, you know? And she was so sad about it. And I started to think about that. I was like, wow, like this child now is basically taught entitlement. Like, if you come in, I owe this to you. I have to give this to you. And basically, she was so hurt by this because she's always been on the giving end of that in her house. Whenever there's guests, she has to put her own self away and do that for the guest. And now in my house, it wasn't like that. And that was really, really hard for this child. And I thought that that was so interesting how basically just like, it was like a reminder of whatever we do to our children, they will think others have to do. And so if I force my child to share, my child will now have this belief that others are obligated to share with them too. Is that not entitlement? Like, is that not like walking around the park thinking that if I want this from this child, they have to give it to me? Like, no one owes you anything. You can ask. And if they say no, we gotta respect, you know? So it's this really, we're not teaching sharing or empathy or compassion. We're teaching entitlement by forcing our kids to share.
Absolutely. And I see this sometimes with adults who grew up in families where there was scarcity, perhaps, and a lot of siblings. And it was, you know, you have to share and you have to finish all your food and you know, you're the younger one, so you get less. And there's all of this kind of, there's a formula and a system based on what those adults considered to be appropriate and just, you know, but when you look at it, then they end up maybe having only one child. And so they start to see like, oh, you know, I've seen this with some of the people in my life where it's like they encounter only children and they think this child is incredibly spoiled. They have it so easy, you know, and it's like, well, they've been taught about sharing life transaction in a very different way, you know? And it's fascinating how our own wounding, let's call it, our own experiences from childhood then transfer into our parenting. I mean, I know this is a highly discussed subject, but how do we take these opportunities every day to view our children as mirrors, right? Because I know that there are certain things that deeply trigger us as adults. And what we do, you know, the classic example is the child is dysregulated and the parent becomes dysregulated because no one ever held their experiences with them. So they just say to the child, go to your room and, you know, come back when you're collected, or go calm down. And when you're presentable, you can come out again and socialize. You know, they don't have the capacity in their own system to sit with that child and get curious, let's say, or there's another adult around and God forbid, they're so embarrassed that the child is having an emotion. And so to not look bad in front of that adult, oh, I don't have a grip on my child. I need to show them that I'm going to show my child. And it becomes this whole mind game. Yeah. So how do we, like when we feel that trigger, you know, or the child does something that deeply upsets us, what is an offering for these adults in that moment to use this as an alchemical opportunity?
Yeah, it's an invitation that feels really uncomfortable, but it's an invitation to expand and to really question what is going on. What is my belief system around what my child is experiencing? Because what happens is it's or us adults, we expand, or we shut down our child and we continue these generational patterns, generation after generation, until one of us, hopefully us, will be the one to expand. You know, this reminds me of a situation where that I was in as a new mom. I remember I wanted my child to learn how to bike. Now, they were really, really young. They must have been 3-4 years old. And I was on a mission. I went to get them a bike. They sat on the bike and they started to pedal, but I guess it was really hard for their little legs. And they weren't pedaling. And I was like, what's going on here? And I was so triggered by it. I went back to the store the next day and I went to get, you know, a more of a toddler type of bike. And I brought it home and I remember feeling like so nervous. Okay, like they're going to bike now. And so I put them on the bike and they were not having it. And I think they felt my stress around it, that they started crying. They're like, no, I don't like to bike. And I'm like, what do you mean? We're biking right now. We're biking. And I remember I was like, actually, like not normal about it. And that like, I went to get them a scooter. I'm like, okay, fine. If you don't want a bike, we got a scooter. And I put all of that away after I saw my child crying. And like, I was like, whoa, what in the world just happened? And what happened was that I never got a chance to bike as a child. And it triggered me so much that like I wanted my child to bike, and the fact that they didn't want to triggered my body so much. It was like, hold on, this is not going to happen again. Like I cannot deal with this. You are going to learn how to bike. My body is not going to re-experience not knowing how to bike as a child. And I literally put all the bikes away and I was open with my child. I said, I'm so sorry. I put so much pressure on you to bike. And what I'm realizing is, it has very little to do with you. It has to do with me. I was never taught how to bike. And here I am trying to shove this on you instead of me going to learn how to bike. So I literally learned how to bike at 30 years old. I went to the park. All the kids around me were biking and I kept falling off my bike. And I said, I'm doing this. I'm going to learn how to bike. And suddenly it was totally okay that my kids didn't know how to bike. And now like each of them know how to bike, but it was done without any pressure. I wasn't triggered, because what was happening was that I needed to expand and I didn't need to shove that on my child. And we do that in various different ways, right? Instead of, for example, you know, learning to be okay with anger, we shut our child's anger down. Like you cannot feel this right now because I can't deal with it. But what if I learned how to deal with anger? Now my child gets a chance to experience the anger, to see, hey, wait, what is anger telling you? You know, what's the message your body's giving you? What's going on here? Let's talk about what, you know, then we approach it in a different way. So triggers from our children specifically is like a mirror holding up to us and saying something within us needs to be looked at. And something within us can expand. And what a beautiful gift it is that our kids provide that with us. And then we begin to realize, hey, I'm not raising my child as an adult. Like, yes, I am an adult raising my child. And here I am growing also alongside my child. And then we can actually perhaps feel grateful that our child triggered us. Like, thanks to this trigger, I now got to expand on whatever it is that they triggered me. And now I have a more fulfilling life, and I'm able to give them the opportunity to be and experience more in their life as well.
Yeah. I mean, just because our bodies develop and we biologically, chronologically grow, that doesn't mean we're actually adults. I know that, you know, they say you turn 18 and now you're an adult, right? However, because of missing initiations, because of a lot of suppressed emotion, we never learned, you know, how to rupture and repair. We end up having our own children. And very often that inner child or that child that's still waiting to be acknowledged, healed, held, you know, whatever it is, comes online. And so very often we see these two, it's almost the real child, right? The one who's actually six, and then the one who's 36, we see both of them kind of dancing as two children who are being highly activated and triggered. And what you said was so beautiful. If you don't expand, the only option is to shut the other person down. And I say the other person because this applies to children, and this also applies in marriage. It's like, if you don't expand in that moment, the only other option is to shut that person down, because maybe they're expressing a need and that need triggers you because for whatever reason, it activates something. So you say, you're not really feeling that, right? The classic gaslight. You're not really feeling that. That's not true. That's not what I did, rather than what you mentioned earlier, which is the acknowledgement of the other person's experience, whether it feels real for us or not, felt real for them. So if we're really there to expand and create safety, we do acknowledge their experience and we ask what would feel good right now, right? We get curious about possibilities. And once everybody's downregulated and there's an understanding, then perhaps some clarity about moving forward can come up. But we, you know, with children, with adults, like, we don't seek that clarity until everybody's downregulated and has felt heard, you know, I would say. So how important is it to teach our children rupture and repair?
I think it is the most important thing, because it exists in all relationships. And when we don't repair, there's a buildup that happens, you know, and we can see it with our kids, even within a day. You know, if let's say something happened, you know, 4 hours earlier with my child and I didn't take the time to repair, and then we're in a different, you know, where we're doing something else and something else bothered them. However, this time they're overly affected by what happened. And usually it has nothing to do with just that moment. It has to do with the buildup of what happened 4 hours later. And then in addition to what's going on now. So it just piles up instead. So I think it's like so important, because we're all going to mess up as human beings. We are human. We are going to mess up. Our kids are going to mess up. Our kids are going to have, you know, to share with us things that we've messed up and they wish we've done better. It's part of raising the next generation. It's just part of life. And it's important to take the time to repair and be honest about things. It's not a reflection of your whole self, right? Like I said before, just because we messed up on one thing, it doesn't mean that overall everything we've done was not good. There's nuance, right? There's a lot of positive things and a lot of negative things that we might have done. And the important part is being honest with ourselves, being able to listen to our child when they talk to us, and understanding that if we validate their reality, it doesn't invalidate our reality. An example for this understanding is, if me and you, we watch a movie, and I find it hilarious. Okay. I'm laughing. It's the most funniest movie for me. and you are crying. You find it terribly sad. Now, none of us are right or wrong. I found it funny. You found it sad. Like, I can validate that you found it sad, and you can validate the fact that I found it funny. We each lived seeing that movie differently. And same is true for our children. They see things through their perspectives. They have their own feelings around things, and they can experience, you know, sometimes, for example, a parent, you know, jokes around with their child, but their child isn't, it's not funny for them. And the child and the parent could say, but it was really funny. I was doing a joke. Well, it's not funny for the child. It doesn't invalidate the fact that you were trying to be funny or you did it as a joke. That's your truth. So being okay with two different realities, ours and our child's, and really trying to think of moments where we felt the way our child felt so that we can really understand them. You know, there are perhaps ways that we can connect to the underlying emotions our child is expressing. And we can tap into that and say, wow, you know, I know how that feels. And I wish I didn't do what I did. I wish I did things differently. And sharing how we would have done things differently can also be helpful because that's reliving the moment with our child, right? This morning, instead of raising my voice and lacking patience with you, I wish that I had given you the time to finish what it was that you were doing. I wish that I would have told you, you know, this and this instead. And listening to how that lands for our child.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, it's never too late in the day, let's say. And what you said is so important, that later on in an activity, a reaction will arise in that child. And it seems like such a surprise. What's going on? Everything's fine. We were just in the middle of this. I don't know where that came from. But really, if we reverse engineer it, we could figure out exactly where it came from. You know, if we're willing to self-reflect. And very often it was like a boundary crossing, a lack of mutual respect, and the child is still processing that. It's like, I look at it as kind of like an open fuse that hasn't been like soldered and closed, you know, and it's just waiting there. And then, you know, time goes on, but it never really was dealt with. And so any moment, you know, even if it's later in the day and you say, remember earlier, it's like, when I did that thing, I don't feel great about it. And I just want to ask you if there's any, you know, whatever starts to, you know, feel natural for you. But the acknowledgement, I think, is really key, like you're saying.
Yes. So,
yeah. Wow. Thank you so much for all of this. It's been incredibly illuminating and also validating. And, you know, there's definitely moments in the conversation where I'm like, yeah, like my inner girl, my, you know, 6-year-old self, 7-year-old self would have loved that, you know. And I think that that's also a guiding principle for those of you listening. If you don't know what to do in the moment, just ask yourself what your 7-year-old might have wanted from your primary caregiver. And that can give you some information, right, as to how to approach the situation. Oh, I would have wanted my mom to perhaps defend me in this situation. So I'm going to stand by my child in this, even if she might be wrong, let's say. I'm going to stand by her. And later on, I'll get curious about what really happened. But in this moment, it's more important for me to stand by her side because that's what I would have wanted, you know?
Yeah. I think we easily forget that if we're not going to be that person for our child, nobody else will. And they're so young, especially, you know, preteen years, all their needs are dependent on us. They can't call up a friend, you know, and get connection through friendships. They're like home with us. They depend on us. They can't just walk out the door and go buy what they need. Like, they're really, really helpless in many ways, as much as they're also not helpless. But in the ways where we need to show up for them, like if we don't, who will? You know, then they're left on their own. And that becomes also part of their blueprint, like I said earlier.
Yeah, the blueprint, it's huge. I mean, it's so much of our behaviors, you know, if we're trying to understand them or the patterns, you know, we go back to that original blueprint or that life script that I believe really starts in the womb, actually, because we're getting a lot of information. When we're in our mother's womb, you know, stress responses, we hear what's going on. There's a consciousness, of course, that's not refuted. And I don't know who's still refuting that, but what would you encourage parents to do in this moment if they're ready to take a step in reconnection? Like, what is one small thing they can do maybe today?
I think children are really good at being honest. And so asking your child, you know, hey, I've been thinking of our relationship. Our relationship really matters to me. And I'm wondering, you know, is there anything that I can do better in our relationship? I'd love to hear. And just being open to hearing what our child has to tell us.
I love that, because that, you know, even if they're nonverbal, I think we'll get information when we ask that.
Yes, if we're open to body cues, you will.
Yeah.
You know, children communicate from a very, very young age. It might not be through words, but they'll show it to us through their bodies.
Absolutely. Sterna, thank you. Thank you for spending this time with me.
My pleasure. It's been really nice sharing this discussion with you.